Hello, and welcome to the Europe at War podcast. Episode 3.2, the 20th of April. The 20th of April had always been one of the most important dates in the Nazi calendar, and that's because it was the Führer's birthday. Before the war, and even during the early years of the war, Hitler's birthday was marked with great pomp and ceremony, as parades of German military units marched proudly through the streets of Berlin. And each year, whilst the people celebrated in the streets, privately, Hitler would be praised to the high heavens by legions of high-ranking Nazi dignitaries and sycophants, who travelled from across the Reich to Berlin in order to pay homage to their great leader in person. The 20th of April 1945, however, was not a date for celebration, as the people of Berlin and the regime itself knew that dark days lay ahead of them. The German defences along the Zielower Heights had collapsed, the Wehrmacht was in full retreat on all fronts, and the Red Army was advancing on Berlin. In a half-hearted effort to inject some birthday cheer into the city, or to perhaps prepare for the hard times ahead, the Nazi leadership authorised extra food rations to be distributed to the people of Berlin, which consisted of 1 pound of bacon or sausage, 1/2 pound of rice or oatmeal, 250 dried lentils, some peas or beans, 1 can of vegetables, 2 pounds of sugar, about 1 ounce of coffee, and some cooking fats. If the authorities were hoping to raise morale, however, then they probably shouldn't have called this extra assignment of food crisis rations, as that rammed home the point that these were indeed far from normal times. The people of Berlin didn't care that it was Hitler's birthday. They were just happy to receive the extra rations, and they were willing to stand for hours queuing patiently for the extra supplies. In fact, the Danish correspondent Jakob Kronecker recalled the burning hatred that many Berliners now had for Adolf Hitler, and how they all secretly hoped that this birthday would be his last. Years ago, they shouted Heil. Now they hate the man who calls himself their Führer. They hate him. They fear him. Because of him, they are suffering hardship and death. But they have neither the strength nor the nerve to free themselves from his demonic power. They wait in passive desperation for the final act of the drama. Ever the heavy sleeper, Hitler rose at 11 a.m. on his birthday, meaning he awoke just in time to enjoy the special birthday treat which the Allied forces had prepared for him. The Allied forces had long circled the 20th of April in their calendars, and they decided to mark the occasion with a breathtaking display of firepower, which could leave no sane person in doubt as to where the endgame was heading. At noon, the US Army Air Force launched a 1,000-bomber raid on Berlin, lasting for 2 hours. And annoyingly for Berlin's defenders, the bombers were able to unleash their loads with impunity, because they flew at such a great height that Berlin's flak towers were unable to reach them. The bombing raid once again disrupted the gas, electricity, and sewage services across Berlin, whilst the water network was also so heavily damaged by the bombs that Berliners were now forced to get their water from public pumps set up in the streets. Once the American raid had finished, RAF mosquitoes continued to harass the Berlin flak towers throughout the day and into the evening, after which the Soviets launched their own air raid on the city. But Berlin wasn't just subjected to death and destruction from the sky on the 20th of April, for it also received the first salvos from the Red Army forces quickly advancing towards the city from the east. Because in the afternoon, as soon as forces from Zhukov's 1st Belarusian Front reached the town of Brno, which lay on the outskirts of Berlin to the northeast, Marshal Zhukov ordered the 79th Rifle Corps of his 3rd Shock Army to immediately start shelling the capital. It seems that this first bombardment from Soviet artillery caused little damage in the city, with the shells falling mainly in the northeastern suburbs, which went unnoticed by the rest of Berlin. However, these shells still struck an important psychological blow, as it represented the first time the Nazi capital had come under direct attack from enemy ground forces. Back in the centre of Berlin, a ludicrous show was still put on to give the pretense of normality, with Himmler, Goering, Speer, and the usual gang of high-ranking Nazi officials arriving in Berlin to give Hitler their best wishes on his birthday. In the past, the Führer's birthday celebrations were characterized by elaborate gifts and long-winded speeches of gratitude. But today, the birthday greetings were hurriedly delivered, and in return, they were met with nothing more than a curt handshake from the birthday boy. The festivities, as you might be tempted to call them, took place in the large rooms of the Reich Chancellery building, which represented a rare excursion for Hitler outside of the oppressive and squalid atmosphere of the Führerbunker, which he had permanently moved into in mid-January 1945. Most of the well-wishers were anxious that the birthday party not last too long, because escape routes out of the city were closing fast, and most were keen to get out whilst they still could. After the speeches were over, Hitler made a visit outside to the Chancellery Garden to greet a carefully selected lineup of SS soldiers and Hitler Youth boys. But even this spectacle was a downbeat farce, which failed to mask the gravity of the situation. Because when Hitler turned to leave this gathering, he gave an energetic Heil Euch to the group, which went unanswered from the assembled troops and boys. More embarrassingly for Hitler, in the uncomfortable silence, all you could hear was the distant rumble of Russian shells falling on the city. Talking of shells, it didn't go unnoticed by those who attended Hitler's birthday that the once great and mighty Führer was now a shell of his former self, as the mental and physical strain, his rapidly progressing Parkinson's, and the mind-numbing daily cocktails of drugs he was taking all combined to give him the appearance of the walking dead. The fact that he spent most of his time locked away safely in the Führerbunker probably didn't help, as the lack of sunshine and fresh air had given him a pasty complexion and puffy features. His eyes were bloodshot, and his left hand trembled uncontrollably. In short, Hitler was a mess. In many ways, Hitler's physical state was a great metaphor for the state Germany found itself in, militarily speaking, in late April 1945. As the Daily Situation Conference, which took place at 4 p.m, laid out bare. Firstly, the complete disintegration of the German defences along the Zillau Heights, combined with the rapid advance of Zhukov's and Konev's fronts, had put Berlin in imminent danger of being surrounded. Secondly, Germany was facing the distinct possibility of being split in two, as the advances of the Western Allies in the west and south of the country, coupled with the Red Army's progress in the east, meant that Germany's enemies could soon link up in the centre of the country. Thirdly, what territory Germany still controlled was rapidly diminishing by the day, with the British heading towards Hamburg and the Americans penetrating deep into Bavaria and advancing towards Czechoslovakia. And last but not least, what remaining forces the Germans could put out into the field were running out of ammo, fuel, and men. Anyone with a pair of eyes and a working brain could see that the game was up, and that Germany's defeat would come in weeks, if not days. But Hitler, ever the stark raving lunatic, refused to accept the reality staring at him in the face. and he insisted that Germany must continue to fight. As a sign of his personal intention to fight until the very end, Hitler declared that he was not leaving Berlin. This surprised everyone present, as many had pinned their hopes on Hitler deciding to leave so that they could leave with him. Indeed, already that day, the wives of OKW Chief Field Marshal Keitel and OKW Chief of Staff General Jodl had flown out of Berlin from Tempelhof Airport on a plane leaving for Prague. But for some people, Hitler's insistence on staying wasn't going to stop them from leaving. And as soon as the daily conference was over, some senior members of Hitler's inner circle, including Himmler and Goering, fled the city as quickly as they could, using hastily invented excuses that they needed to leave Berlin on urgent business. Whilst the German leadership stared at their maps in the Führerbunker and despaired over their military situation, the Soviets established their positions outside of Berlin in anticipation of their assault on the city. To the northeast of Berlin, once Zhukov's forces had arrived in Bernau and fired off their salvo of artillery shells onto the capital, the casual observer might have expected this salvo to be followed up by an immediate rush into the city. In reality, however, Zhukov's forces were unable to attack Berlin due to two simple reasons. Firstly, the town of Bernau had to be cleared out of German troops. So Zhukov sent in the 4th Polish Infantry Division from the 1st Polish Army to pacify the town. The Germans weren't willing to give Bernau up easily, however, and running street battles erupted between the defending troops and the attacking Poles, which lasted all day. And it was only when the Soviet 47th Army joined the fight in the town that the German defenders were finally crushed. The second factor which prevented Zhukov from immediately assaulting Berlin was the fact that he had to spend the 20th of April reassessing the strength of his forces and adjusting his plans for the assault on Berlin. Remember, Zhukov's armies have just spent the last 4 days fighting brutally along the Zelower Heights. And the unexpected quagmire of the battle there had led to incredibly high losses for his forces. The slog through the German defences at the Zelower Heights had cost the lives of at least 30,000 Soviet soldiers, with many thousands more wounded or missing. Yes, Zhukov still had hundreds of thousands of men at his disposal, but the heavy cost of the victory at the Zelower Heights forced him to reinforce his depleted frontline units, and it also forced him to rejig his attack plan for Berlin. For instance, the Third Shock Army, which had originally been assigned with attacking and capturing the entire northern half of Berlin, was now too depleted to attack such a large area by itself. Therefore, the Third Shock Army was given new orders to focus only on the north and northeastern districts of the city, whilst the 47th Army was instead given the objective of attacking Spandau in the northwest. Meanwhile, Zhukov ensured that the remainder of his forces earmarked for the assault on Berlin spent the rest of the 20th of April being resupplied with ammunition, fuel, and where possible, troops. Yes, Zhukov was focused on capturing Berlin as quickly as possible, but he knew the size of the challenge which lay before him, and he wanted to ensure that his 1st Belarusian Front forces were in the strongest possible position to seize the capital. However, the fact that Zhukov had ordered the artillery salvo on Berlin on the 20th of April was not driven simply out of a desire to cause Hitler one more headache on his birthday. It was also a deliberate move by Zhukov to stake a claim to Berlin, and to show Stalin that it had been his forces and not Konev's, which had been the first to reach the Nazi capital. This fear of losing out to Konev wasn't unwarranted, as Konev's tank armies were still cutting through huge swathes of territory in central Brandenburg, rapidly advancing towards the south of Berlin. Yes, Zhukov had been the first to shell Berlin with an artillery barrage, but he was also fixated on being the first to actually enter Berlin. So upon hearing of Konev's rapid advance towards southern Berlin, Zhukov quickly ordered his 1st and 2nd Guards tank armies to send their best tank brigades into Berlin immediately, with the goal that they must reach the outskirts of Berlin by 4 a.m. the next day. This was optimistic, however, as the fighting around Bernau, combined with the exhaustion that these armies were suffering due to the intensity of the fighting at the Zelor Heights and the subsequent rapid march towards Berlin, meant it would take them until the evening of the 21st of April to actually reach the city outskirts. In the meantime, however, in preparation for Zhukov's assault on Berlin the next day, 713 bombers of the Soviet 18th and 16th Air Armies were dispatched to bomb German positions in the north and northeast of the city, softening them up for Zhukov's forces. With the Red Army literally at their door, the Germans should have concentrated their efforts on engaging with Zhukov's forces in Bernau, or they should have redoubled their efforts to fortify Berlin's defences in anticipation for the impending Russian assault on the city. Instead, the German leadership faffed around, reorganising the command structure for the defence of Berlin, as they decided to transfer the Berlin defence area to the authority of Army Group Vistula. Army Group Vistula was led by General Gotthard Heinrici, who was a solid tactician and effective military leader. However, he was already juggling with the collapse of the German 9th Army along the River Oder front line, so he surely didn't relish the extra assignment of now having to oversee the defence of Berlin as well. In any case, Heinrici immediately contacted General Reymann in Berlin and instructed him not to blow any of the city's bridges, as this would hamper the movement of garrison troops and supplies around the city. Heinrici's next order, however, was questionable to say the least, as he also instructed Reymann to send as many Volkssturm units as he could to bolster Army Group Vistula forces outside of Berlin. Heinrici's goal here was to engage the Soviet forces outside of the city, as he desperately wanted to avoid fighting taking place within Berlin. This was for numerous reasons. Firstly, Heinrici knew the city could not be adequately defended, because Berlin possessed so few garrison troops, it was impossible to effectively man the defence rings outside of the city, nor the defensive positions within the city. Secondly, Heinrici knew that if the Germans fell back to the city, then the inevitable street fighting to follow would strip his forces of several tactical advantages. For example, German tanks would be unable to move around freely in the battle-damaged streets, whilst artillery fire would also be severely limited as the densely packed buildings robbed the gunners of a clear field of fire. And lastly, Heinrici also wanted to avoid the unnecessary loss of civilian life, which was guaranteed to happen if house-to-house fighting broke out in the city. This desire from Heinrici to avoid fighting in Berlin might have been built on solid tactical and humanitarian grounds, but it also matched Hitler's deluded state, as it reinforced his belief that the German front line along the River Oder could be reconstituted, therefore blunting the Soviet advance and keeping Berlin safe from assault, at least for the time being. Hitler, and by extension the entirety of the German senior military leadership, had become fixated on the importance of the Zelower Heights and of the River Oder. Thus, even when the defence lines along the Zelower Heights had been smashed to pieces, there still existed a lingering belief that the Russians could somehow be pushed back to the heights and perhaps beyond the River Oder as well. This was utter madness, of course, because by the 20th of April, it was simply impossible for the Germans to re-establish a strong defensive line to the east of Berlin. The truth was, their armies along the Zielower Heights were in full flight, and they had been split into multiple pieces. Therefore, the Soviet advance on the capital was unstoppable, and regardless of Heinrich's or Hitler's intentions to keep the fighting from entering Berlin, the fact was that Zhukov's forces were already in Bernau, so to all intents and purposes, the fighting had already reached Berlin. Despite this reality, Hitler readily agreed to Heinrich's call for reinforcements to be dispatched from Berlin. So on the evening of the 20th of April, Hitler ordered that all available soldiers in Berlin not engaged in the defence of the capital should be sent to the front immediately. And to bolster the fighting spirit of these reinforcements, Hitler sent a message to the troops that our warmest wishes go with them. Berliners were then treated to the outrageous sight of buses and taxis filled with Volkssturm and Wehrmacht troops leaving Berlin. Not heading for Bernau, where they should have gone, but instead heading for what they believed to be the German front line along the River Oder. These buses and taxis soon ran head-on into shattered remnants of German units who were being chased back to Berlin by marauding Soviet tank armies. And then, to make matters worse, the buses and taxis were hit with barrages of Soviet tank fire, ripping the reinforcements to shreds. Of course, the idea of sending in reinforcements to save a front line, which had already collapsed, is ludicrous. But more importantly for the defence of Berlin, the decision to send these reinforcements out of the city to a quick and pointless death stripped the Berlin garrison of troops it desperately needed to repel the Soviet forces, which were poised to attack the city.